recently been retaken from ISIS occupation. Erbil was the capital of Kurdistan, a relatively safe and quiet city of just under 1 million residents. It was an eclectic mix of modern and ancient structures and boasted beautiful green spaces, towering fountains, and winding mosaic-tiled streets. Cars jammed the avenues. Men sat and smoked outside coffee shops lining the sidewalks. Families walked together in public. Commerce was in full swing. Leaving the historic city, they hit a main road that took them north. In contrast to much of Iraq, it appeared to Rhys that the north was a virtual paradise. It reminded him of the Napa Valley wine country where he had been married.
"So, tell me about your crew," Freddy said, bringing them back to the present.
"All Yazidis," Spur began. "They're not Muslims, and they've been heavily persecuted by Daesh. You know, ISIS. They hate the bad guys more than we do, so they're extremely loyal."
"Aren't all Peshmerga loyal to the U.S.?" Rhys asked.
"Yeah, that's true for the most part. They have a chip on their shoulder, which is useful. They've been the ethnic and religious minority here forever. Actually, they're a minority within a minority. I have them on loan from Qasem Sheshto, the old tiger of Mount Sinjar. He's the commander of the Yazidi Pesh forces."
"What's the mission up here?" asked Freddy, his eyes scanning the road ahead.
"We're running a strike force against what's left of Daesh, ISIS, ISIL, whatever you want to call them this week. We have two commando squadrons of Yazidis trained up, and we're doing a lot of direct action work. We use their Humint networks along with all of our SIGINT assets and are hitting the enemy hard."
"Sounds like Baghdad 2006, Rhys commented.
"Yeah, but this time we're not getting Americans killed. These people need to win back their own country."
Rhys had seen plenty of Iraqi troops get killed or wounded fighting for their country, particularly from Mo's teams, but he didn't press the point. As they traveled farther from the city, the flat terrain transformed into rolling hills. Their journey led them into a wide valley where a modern compound had been built into the remote landscape. The exterior perimeter of sand-filled HESCO barriers, the modern-day equivalent of the lodgepole forts of the American frontier, screamed, "U.S. Outpost." The force protection detail was a mix of local forces and Western security contractors. Inside the perimeter was a complex of concrete and steel structures at odds with the natural world outside its walls. The CIA had built its own fiefdom in this autonomous zone, a place where even the Iraqi army was prohibited from entering by law.
"Freddy, does this remind you at all of Apocalypse Now?" Rhys whispered, referencing the classic 1979 film by Francis Ford Coppola.
"Yes, and I expect we've already met our Kurtz."
Landry lay shivering on the floor, his body convulsing in its attempt to stay warm. With his hands bound behind his back, the best he could do was to draw his knees up to his chest. Without the stifling heat and claustrophobia of the rug, he'd begun to calm down and re-enter the land of the sane. He'd tried scooting himself around the room to get his bearings and build up some body heat, but the abrasive floors quickly rubbed his skin raw. He'd established that the room was roughly 10 feet by 10 feet and had a metal drain in the center of the floor. It was well-built, almost clinical. The only ambient smell was that of the dried urine and feces that clung to his skin. He was sure of one thing. His captors were state-sponsored. Terrorist groups didn't run detainment facilities with massive air conditioners and clean concrete floors. He had to be within 1,000 or so miles of where he'd been snatched. It wouldn't have made sense to take him deeper into Europe, which probably meant somewhere in the former Soviet Union, Syria, Iraq, or Iran.
Pakistan, maybe?
The Brits would want him desperately for the Christmas market attack in London, but, despite the effectiveness of their military, their government no longer had the stomach to operate in places like this. Too many colonial memories. Could the French have picked him up?
They didn't play games when it came to terrorism. Instead of keeping their citizens from going to fight the infidel in foreign lands, France let them go. They let them go so that French special operations troops could hunt them down and kill them on foreign soil. But the French didn't have a footprint in this part of the world. That left the United States, the Russians, or maybe the Israelis.
Please don't let it be the Russians.
His thoughts were broken by a brief sound that was audible over the air conditioners, and seconds later his body was shocked by a blast of freezing cold liquid. The water hit him like icy daggers, and he curled his body tighter into a more protective position. He tried worm-crawling away from the cold stream raining from above, but it appeared as if the entire ceiling was equipped with shower nozzles. There was no escaping it. After an excruciating 60 seconds, the shower stopped as abruptly as it had started. A minute earlier, he hadn't thought he could be any closer to hypothermia, but that now seemed like a warm summer day by comparison. He knew this playbook. They were going to keep him on the verge of hypothermia coupled with sleep deprivation. For someone raised on the hot, steamy bayous of the Gulf Coast, this was torture. Yet he knew what was coming and could play this game as well.
If it's the Americans, I still have a chance.
Chapter 56. Yazidi Strike Force Compound, Kurdistan, September.
Would you like to observe? Eric asked Reese and Freddy with a tad too much enthusiasm, both men having stowed their gear in the dormitory-like rooms to which they'd been shown.
No thanks, Reese responded without hesitation, remembering his last experience with torture, extracting information from Saul Agnon in a Palm Springs hotel room for his role in the murders of Reese's wife and daughter.
Me neither, Freddy chimed in. I'd prefer to maintain some plausible deniability if this thing hits the news cycle. Remember what the last president did to the guys who interrogated Abu Zubaydah?
Neither man had any moral objections to whatever interrogation techniques were being used on Landry. They simply weren't interested in watching. Landry was a traitor, a sellout, who'd become a terrorist due to a currently unknown motivation. His actions had taken innocent lives and he'd joined forces with his nation's number one enemy. On top of all that, he was a sadist who had tortured detainees under the guise of a CIA team leader. No, Jules Landry wasn't going to get any empathy from either of them.
Suit yourselves. I'm going to go see how it's going, Spurs said as he walked out.
They'd been lounging in the team room, a combination clubhouse, living room, and meeting space used by small units around the globe. This one was nicer than most, but lacked the photos, captured enemy weapons, and other mementos that usually lined the walls and infused the space with the character of the occupying unit. With no such decorations, this room looked more like something you'd see in a nursing home or college dorm. It occurred to Reese that he hadn't watched television since he'd hastily departed the United States months ago, so he turned on the flat screen to see if he could catch the news. He found CNN International and, ironically, the segment was covering the killing of Nawaz by the now-famous Albanian Eagle Commandos. He and Freddy exchanged eye rolls as a series of counter-terrorism experts and retired military officers speculated wildly about how the mission had gone down. How these officers with high-level security clearances could spout off about ongoing military operations just days after they'd retired was beyond them both. The freezing water soaked him at seemingly random intervals, leaving Landry constantly on edge in anticipation of the next icy blast, his body jerking uncontrollably. Then, just when his mind began to slip into delirium, the powerful air vents in the room started blowing warm air. The warmth was heavenly. As his body temperature began to rise, he was reminded of just how thirsty he was. He hadn't had anything to drink since before his capture, and he was losing track of how long ago that had been. Every part of his body was soaking wet, save the inside of his mouth. Had his lips not been covered by tape, he would have licked the floor. His head rose at the sound of the heavy metal door unlocking and quickly tucked it back against his chest, expecting a beating to begin at any moment. Footsteps sloshed across the wet floor. Whoever had entered the room smelled like cigarettes and was standing directly over him. The man pulled the wet cloth sack from his head, and the duct tape that had covered his mouth was torn swiftly away, the sharp pain only slightly diminished by the numbness of his face. His eyes were still taped over, so when something touched his lips, he jerked away, causing water to spill on his chin. Water! His natural fear of physical pain was suppressed by his overwhelming thirst, and he extended his face toward the bottle. The cold liquid instantly brightened his mood as he gulped it down. The bottle was pulled away and something small was pressed into his mouth. It had a plastic taste to it. He tried to spit it out, but the water returned and his thirst was too powerful. Whatever it was, he just swallowed it. He pushed the thought aside and drank the water as fast as it was poured into his mouth by the plastic bottle. The pleasure was short-lived. As quickly and abruptly as the water had come, the man left the room. Still, his body was shivering less as the room warmed, and he was no longer quite as dehydrated as he'd been just moments earlier. He'd learned, during the various schools he'd attended in the Marine Corps, to relish the brief moments of rest and relief when they came, without thinking too much about what might happen next. He exhaled a deep breath and tried to put himself in a different place mentally. A happy place. Just as he began to relax, his skin was blasted once again by the cold rain from above. It was like they were reading his mind. A sensor in the interrogation room's wall relayed the telemetry from the RFID device inside the detainee's body to the desktop monitor in the observation area. Roman Evdal, a Yazidi physician's assistant trained in the United States under an exchange program, watched the detainee's core temperature rise to 37 degrees Celsius and his heart rate slow to 65 BPM. Rome, as he was called by the Americans at the facility, nodded to the man seated next to him, who touched his computer screen, activating the water pumps that fed the shower nozzles that covered the ceiling of the interrogation room. Rome couldn't hear the detainee scream through the thick plexiglass with the speakers muted, but he could tell by the man's agonized facial expression that that was exactly what was happening. He looked over his shoulder toward the handsome Sunni, whom he'd been instructed to address as Major, and received an almost imperceptible nod in response. The Major didn't look like he was part of the Iraqi army, and Rome suspected that he was part of the more powerful and secretive Interior Ministry. Not that it mattered. Whoever he was and whoever he worked for, he was clearly in charge of this interrogation. RFID-equipped body temperature monitors had been used for several years to monitor students' core body temperatures in the U.S. Navy's brutal Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL training program. Breaking the will of would-be SEALs required keeping the men on the verge of hypothermia while going through Hell Week, the crucible of SEAL training that tied every generation of frogmen to the next. Men sometimes died as a result of this delicate dance, and the RFID monitors allowed instructors to instantly assess a trainee's body temperature by pointing a digital reader device at his torso. Having experienced the debilitating effects of cold firsthand as a BUDS student and later as an instructor, one of the agency personnel involved in the construction of the interrogation facility had the bright idea of applying the technology in conjunction with room temperature manipulations as a method of breaking detainees without laying a hand on them. Not only could they keep them teetering on the edge of hypothermia, but they could prevent them from sleeping. Cold, exhaustion, and hunger are three of nature's most powerful forces, and they could use all three simultaneously with almost no risk of long-term physical harm. A healthy, fit male of Landry's age was unlikely to suffer a cardiac event under such stress, but a crash cart was available just in case. This was the first time this comprehensive system had been attempted on a real prisoner, and so far, it was working just as advertised.
Chapter 57. "Has he seen your face yet, Mo?" Reese asked across the team room's dinner table. The food here was exceptional, just like he remembered from his time attached to the agency in Iraq, and they always had honey for his coffee.
"Not yet. I think we'll give it another day or so before I try to talk to him. The longer he goes without human interaction, the better. The cold and lack of sleep will break him. The isolation only helps exacerbate it."
"Mo, it always kills me that you have a better command of the English language than I do," Reese smiled. "And that British accent of yours makes you sound like an Oxford professor."
"You love to play the surfer boy, Reese, but I know better. I remember the stack of books in your room in Baghdad. No one has brought that much reading material to war since Churchill," Mo observed.
"Just trying to learn as much as I could about counterinsurgency and your country's history and culture. If you think I read a lot, you should see Freddy's book stack."
"I just look at the pictures," Freddy interjected.
Mo turned the conversation back to the issue at hand.
"So, what do you want me to find out from Landry? He's almost ready to break."
"The big question is, who is he working for and why, but more who than why, if that makes sense," Freddy responded.
"And how many other agents and teams he's running?" Reese chimed in. "We know he was handling at least two parallel teams, yours and the Stew from your old unit who hit us in North Africa. If he was also behind the Christmas market attack in London, that would bring us up to three at a minimum. There could very well be more we don't know about." Mo scribbled some notes in a small, spiral-bound book. Reese leaned forward, his mind working the problem.
"And we need to know how he knew to attack us in Redacted. No one outside of the agency should have had that info. It's not like we got hit by some local militia group who found out there were some random Americans living down the road. That team was brought in specifically to target us. We've obviously got ourselves a leak, and Mo, your future depends on us finding out where that leak is."
Chapter 58. Fairfax County, Virginia, September. Oliver Gray hated Dulles Airport. Its architecture was, to him, a glaring symbol of Cold War dominance, an obnoxious vision of America's arrogance during a period when so many in the world were rebuilding and suffering. He had a more practical reason to hate it as well. One never knew whether the Transportation Security Administration line would take 5 minutes or 2 hours. He found some ironic amusement in the fact that he used the pre-check lane, though with the number of regular travelers in the D.C. area, it was barely faster than the normal security line. The CIA analyst ordered a large Dunkin' coffee and picked up the latest Brad Thor novel while he waited impatiently for it to cool. "Spymaster," he said silently to himself, already imagining himself in the lead role. Surely he'd be able to secure a good roast in St. Petersburg, but he assumed that there would be very few afternoons spent at his beloved sidewalk cafes in the immediate future due to the weather. It maddened Gray that he would have to transfer in Newark, in a middle seat, no less, in order to make his connection to Europe. But it was a minor inconvenience on his way to his new life, a life of meaning. After this mission was complete, he would be